welcome to the Science Podcast for February 13th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, pointing and gesturing with toddlers may help with their vocabulary when they go to school, the first draft of the Neanderthal genome, and seeing the far side of the moon. All this and more, plus a roundup of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
This week, we start with a request. We want to know what you think of the show. Of course, you can always write us via our email address, sciencepodcast@aaas.org, but we've also put together a short, anonymous online survey and would very much appreciate it if you would fill it out. Would you please? You can find it at our website, sciencemag.org/multimedia. Thank you. Now on with the show. Before babies talk, they typically are full of gestures. Arms up in the air suggests, pick me up. Holding an imaginary cup suggests that toddler wants a drink. And many parents know that they can teach their pre-verbal toddlers gestures too. Hungry? As a parent, you might point to your mouth. It takes repetition, but that's how we learn vocabulary too. In a paper in this week's Science, Meredith Rowe and Susan Golden Meadow report that the gestures children learn as toddlers correlates with how many words they know when they start school. While the researchers don't yet know why pre-vocal gesturing seems to lead to larger vocabularies, the research does suggest a possible explanation for why kids from families with higher socioeconomic status know more words when they start school. It's because their parents tend to gesture more. I spoke with Rowe from her office at the University of Chicago.
The real phenomenon here that we're investigating is the fact that socioeconomic status is related to language. If you look at children when they enter school, for example, children from higher SES backgrounds tend to have much larger vocabularies than children from lower SES backgrounds. And so that's the real phenomenon that we want to explain, primarily because vocabulary at school entry is a key predictor of success in school. So that's what we're doing here. And there's other research that has shown pretty convincingly that parental talk with children is an important factor during the early childhood years. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to ask about parent and child gesture and whether that relates to socioeconomic status, because we weren't sure whether or not it would. So the real question was, do we see SES differences in parent and child gesture use? And if so, do those differences in child gesture then relate to their later differences in vocabulary?
How did you quantify the socioeconomic status or SES of these families?
Right, that's a great question. So socioeconomic status is usually quantified by three typical indicators. So the parent's education level, the family's income, and the parent's occupation. And in this study, we selected our sample to be diverse in socioeconomic status so that they would represent the sort of demographics of the Chicago area in terms of family income. And we used income and education as our indicators of SES and actually created a composite of those two measures. Our data on parent occupation wasn't so great, and there were some issues there because a lot of these mothers had been working but were now staying at home because of the children. So we chose to use education and income.
And so what did you and your co-author do in measuring the gestures among these children and their parents?
Well, my co-author and mentor, Susan Golden Meadow, is an expert in gesture studies. She's been studying gesture for many years, and she has found many times that looking at the meanings produced in gesture, we have found, is a better predictor of children's language than looking at the overall amount of gesture. So, for example, if a child points at a doll, we would call the meaning of that gesture doll. Often you'll see young children hold their arms up if they want to be picked up. We would call that an up gesture, things like that. And so we looked at how parents and children communicate during this early period, you know, with toddlers. We looked at particularly at 14 months. But what we do to quantify this is we go into the homes and we videotape the parents and the children interacting as they normally would for about 90 minutes. And then we take those videos and we bring them back to the lab and we transcribe and, you know, in a written form, all the gestures and speech that occur during the interaction.
Is the act itself of measuring the gestures, videotaping the families, likely to affect the amount of gesturing? People at different socioeconomic status levels may be more or less comfortable with scientific studies, so could behave differently when the camera is on.
I think that's a good question. I think that's also why we chose to stay for 90 minutes rather than just, you know, 5 or 10, thinking that, you know, the families might become more comfortable the longer we're there. I don't know. You know, we followed these families now for 5 or 6 years and haven't seen any sort of changes over time in these parents and, you know, in how they interact with their kids as they've become more comfortable with us. But I would assume that to an certain extent, they are, or they might be acting on their best behavior, or, you know, acting as they might think we would expect them to. But nonetheless, we do this in an ecologically valid way as possible by, you know, going into the home rather than bringing them into the lab, just to get the most naturalistic sample of data that we can.
So at the beginning of this study, the children are aged 14 months.
That's right.
Were there any differences between the verbal or gestural vocabulary of the families at these different socioeconomic status levels?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So when the children are 14 months, they're just at the early stages of language learning. So they're starting to produce some words, but are not saying all that much. And actually, at this age, we do not see any differences in the children's vocabulary, spoken vocabulary, based on their socioeconomic status. But I think what is striking is that as early as 14 months at this time period, we do see differences in their gesture use based on their socioeconomic status. And these are differences favoring the higher SES groups.
And those gestures they're learning from their parents?
Yes, exactly. Well, we're able to show in this study that there is a strong relationship between parent gesture and child gesture. So our results indicate that the SES differences in children's gesture are due to their parents' gesturing. So sort of suggests the situation where the higher SES parents are gesturing about more things in their environment, which then might lead the children of those higher SES parents to gesture about more things in their environment, which then subsequently leads to having a larger vocabulary later on.
So by the end of this study, then, mm-hmm. 5 or 6 years later, as you say, what about the verbal and gestural vocabulary of the families then?
So what we did was we looked at the children when they were 4.5, so it was just over 3 years later, and we found that, you know, as we expected, there were SES differences in children's vocabulary. And what was interesting is that it did relate directly to the children's gesture use when they were 14 months.
So the parents' gesturing mm-hmm. is highly correlated with the socioeconomic status?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
But nonetheless, the gesturing itself is even more highly correlated with the children gesturing and subsequently having bigger vocabularies.
That's right. So that's sort of the pathway of the results, the parent gesture relates to child gesture, which relates to child later vocabulary. And it seems like the window of time is important here. Once children get old enough to talk a lot, you know, if we looked not at 14 months, but much later, I don't think the gesture would be as important as the children's speech. It's just that there's this early period where we do see social class differences in children's gesturing before they're even saying much. And I think that's really striking. And it relates to their vocabulary later on. I mean, previous research has also highlighted parent speech to children, and that's another important factor. But I think we're getting there. I mean, I think looking closely at what's going on between parents and children during this early childhood period is giving us some answers to why there is such a large SES gap in vocabulary when children enter school.
At this point, are there any lessons for parents using more gestures when they speak, more gesture types, mm-hmm. perhaps to help their kids learn more words and so potentially be better in school?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, our results, our analyses are correlational. They're not causal. We're not proving that one thing causes another here, but it would certainly suggest that that might be the case. And I think some future research could look at that. I think that it would be important to determine whether or not if you encourage parents and young children to gesture more, whether that would in fact increase their vocabularies. But assuming that that might be the case, I think, you know, again, we're talking about the gestures that parents just use naturally when they speak. And most of these are pointing gestures. And it certainly, I don't think, would hurt to encourage parents to talk more and gesture more while they're talking with their young language learning children.
Meredith Rowe, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Meredith Rowe is lead author of a paper on the correlation between a toddler's gestures and a preschool child's vocabulary. Read the paper in this week's Science. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, is continuing to draw the attention of lawmakers. In recent years, critics have charged that the agency isn't doing enough to maintain food and drug safety, in part because of a shortage of funding and staff. Here with more about it is Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
President Obama recently pledged a complete review of FDA operations. Two members of Congress have also introduced bills to reform the agency. First, former House Energy and Commerce Committee Chairman John Dingell formalized his plan after much discussion last year. His bill would give the FDA authority to recall unsafe drugs and devices and would institute industry registration fees to help cover facility inspection costs. Representative Rosa DeLauro, who is head of the Agriculture Panel of the House Appropriations Committee, has introduced the Food Safety Modernization Act, which would significantly change FDA's structure. She favors splitting off the food safety part of the agency into a separate division within the Department of Health and Human Services. This bill, if passed, would address criticism of government handling of a recent salmonella outbreak in a Georgia peanut processing plant, linked to at least 8 deaths and hundreds of illnesses. One point raised was that the FDA had to obtain agreement from the company involved in order to recall the peanut products produced. The new division would be able to institute mandatory recalls without prior industry approval.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Neanderthals and modern humans coexisted for hundreds of thousands of years, but these close cousins of ours died out around 30,000 years ago. And until recently, that meant that studying what DNA made modern humans human involved comparing our genome with that of chimpanzees and other primates. Now, as news writer Elizabeth Panisi reports in this week's Science, researchers have overcome many technical hurdles and are completing the first draft of the Neanderthal genome.
What the Neanderthal genome can teach us is about our evolution, how modern humans got to be the way they are. We have the sequence of the chimpanzee, and by comparing that sequence to the sequence of modern humans, we know there are 35 million differences between us and the chimpanzees. By having the Neanderthal genome, we can look at then what's different between us and Neanderthals and get a better idea of what it is that specifically made us human, modern humans, as opposed to just human-like.
At this point, how much of the Neanderthal genome is sequenced?
The goal of the project was to sequence the genome one time over, get the full genome one time over. But the way sequencing works is that even though they have sequenced 3 billion base pairs, which is about the size of the genome, some of that sequence represents a base being sequenced more than once, so there are some bases that are not represented in the new genome at all. So altogether, they have 60% of the genome covered.
Is it particularly important to have more than one copy of the Neanderthal genome, or is once enough once they get to the 100% level?
Well, to cover the genome once over is really not enough. To sequence the human genome, initially, they had covered it 12 times over. In other words, each base was determined an average of 12 times. And the reason that you do this is because there's two things that go on. One is you want to sequence each base in the genome more than once. By doing that, you know with a greater degree of certainty that the base that you say it is really the base that it is. You want to sequence multiple copies of the genome because you want multiple individuals sequenced. Because you and I have differences in our genomes that we wouldn't know about unless your genome and my genome were sequenced. Right now we have about a half dozen human genomes sequenced and people are able to see there are certain places where we vary. In the Neanderthal genome, by only having one Neanderthal genome, then you don't see where they vary. And so you might see a difference between the human and the Neanderthal that isn't really a difference. So when you see a difference between the Neanderthal and the human, you don't really understand the importance of that difference unless you have multiple copies of the Neanderthal genome.
Have there been any technical problems in sequencing the Neanderthal? There must be lots of samples. They were discovered 150 years ago.
Well, there are lots of samples, but every fossil is considered quite priceless. And up until recently, it required quite a lot of sample in order to get any DNA from it. The problem with ancient DNA is that as DNA ages, it breaks down. And there can be chemical modifications that change the sequence from what it was to something different. A second problem is that fossil DNA tends to be full of other DNA, especially microbes, fungus, and even humans that have handled the bone. So when they try to sequence Neanderthal DNA, they have to worry about also sequencing all this other DNA.
So is the effort then to prevent any contamination from occurring, or can scientists still use these contaminated, degraded sequences to learn something?
The scientists have taken a twofold approach. One is there's a technique now used for sequencing microbes called metagenomics, where you sequence everything that's in the environment, and then you compare those sequences to the known genomes to be able to identify what's there and what's not there. And what's made that possible is now sequencing is fairly cheap. So you can sequence a lot of DNA for very little, relatively very little money. And then if it turns out 90% of what you sequence is microbial in origin, you just throw that out, and you don't think about that anymore. And this is what they do with sequencing the Neanderthal genome, is they sequence billions and billions and billions of base pairs and threw out more than 90% of it and only kept the stuff that looked like humans. A second thing that they have done is they look for DNA that's not been contaminated. So one of the big problems, especially with Neanderthal DNA, is trying to minimize the amount of human, modern human DNA that might also be wrapped up in the sample. And to do that, researchers who are collecting these bones from caves and wherever use clean room procedures. They wear gloves, they wear masks. When they extract the bones, when they dig out the bones, they freeze the samples right away, and then when they extract the DNA, they extract the DNA in clean room situations. That helps minimize the amount of human contamination. Then they have several ways of checking to make sure that what they've sequenced is really Neanderthal DNA. So even without having a whole sequence in hand, researchers in the last couple of years have been able to look at Neanderthal genes and compare them with humans. And the way they do this is they have a gene in mind, a human gene in mind, and they look for that particular gene in Neanderthal sequence that they have on hand. And they're able to probe for that particular gene. So that's why, for example, last year, we found out that Neanderthals carry a gene, a pigmentation gene, that means that some of them likely had red hair and light skin. And in December, another study showed that at least some Neanderthals had type O blood. That targeted approach is useful if you know what gene you want to try and compare, human to Neanderthal. What the full genome does, it lets you see the whole landscape of the Neanderthal genome, and you can immediately pick out all the differences and find genes that you didn't realize might be different between humans and Neanderthals.
So the message overall here is that scientists have reached a milestone in sequencing the Neanderthal genome, but we don't know how long the road to the full Neanderthal genome is.
Right. This is a milestone, but I think now that they've worked out how to do the sequencing efficiently, how to minimize contaminating human DNA, I think you'll see rapid progress. They are already doing a higher coverage of the Neanderthal genome that they've sequenced, and they also have three or four other Neanderthal fossils that they're doing sequencing of. So we will not only get deeper coverage of the single Neanderthal genome, we will get multiple copies of genomes as well. And those are what we need to really make sense of what the differences are between us and Neanderthals.
Liz Panisi, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science news writer Elizabeth Panisi reports on the first draft of the Neanderthal genome. Read her article in this week's Science. Japan's Kaguya Selene spacecraft is the largest mission to the moon since the Apollo program. Launched in late 2007, the spacecraft actually consists of three orbiters, two with scientific instruments and one that relays the data to and from Earth. That lets the Kaguya Selene mission do something no lunar mission has done before: observe the entire moon. In four papers in this week's Science, researchers report their analysis of data thus far from the Kaguya-Selene mission, and in a perspective in this week's Science, Greg Newman and Erwan Nazarico write about the new results. The underlying theme is that the moon is very lopsided, has a peculiar gravity field, and that the data from the spacecraft may help researchers figure out how the moon came to be the way it is. I spoke with Newman and Nazarico from their offices at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Here's Greg Newman.
The moon is the oldest record that we have available of the early solar system and its formation. And even though we have some very good theories about how the moon was formed, there are a lot of discrepancies that remain to be resolved. Following the formation of the moon, it's thought that it was covered with one huge ocean of molten magma. We don't know what happened to that magma ocean. It's clear that there was an ocean of lava that then settled and crystallized and differentiated and formed the lunar crust as we see it today, excepting battered a little bit. We don't know if it was a global ocean. We don't know how hot the interior of the moon was at that time. These are all the boundary conditions for models, which we hope will eventually agree with the observations that we can make today.
So, Erwan, how is the Japanese Selene Kaguya mission helping to solve these mysteries that Greg talked about?
Well, so the Kaguya spacecraft is a very capable spacecraft with a suite of scientific instruments that will inform us more on the moon by bringing newer, higher resolution data sets. And in particular here, the four papers that are presented in the issue of Science are the lunar radar sounder, the terrain camera, the laser altimeter, and also a gravity experiment. And all of us will give us more detail on the history of the moon with a slightly different aspect of geophysics. For example, the terrain camera would give us high-resolution images, and we can do like estimate the ages of smaller areas on the moon and detect volcanism like much later than what we thought had happened on the far side. So all those instruments are very complementary, and can bringing them together is actually going to be very powerful.
Now, Greg, Erwan mentioned more detail. Didn't previous missions to the moon?
Well, it goes back 50 years when the first lunar orbiters flew by the moon and found that it had no main dynamo-produced magnetic field. They saw the far side. The Russians took television pictures of the far side, and they saw that it was completely different from the visible near side of the moon. The Apollo missions had very sophisticated radar tracking that enabled us to measure the gravitational signal of regions on the moon. And the great surprise was, and this is totally unlike Earth, holes dug out by giant impacts. These holes on the moon actually had positive gravity anomalies, and that caused perturbations to the spacecraft's orbit, which were very important to understand. They didn't want to crash into the moon. The Apollo orbiters flew as low as 19 kilometers, I believe, above the moon and were in danger of crashing into the moon at any point.
So these previous missions then didn't offer the detail, and it's this detail that we're getting from the Kaguya mission that is really going to be able to help us tell more about the moon so we can solve these essentially geophysical mysteries.
Yeah, I'd like to fast forward a bit to the Clementine mission in 1994, where we got, for the first time, a polar orbiting satellite so that we could see something outside of the equatorial band. And following that, in 1998, 99, Lunar Prospector did geochemical mapping and very detailed gravity mapping, but they were both constrained by the orbits in which they were positioned and by the tracking that was available. Neither of them could track on the far side of the moon.
How does the Kaguya do that?
Kaguya has actually two small satellites weighing about 50 kilograms each, the Relay satellite and the VLBI satellite, that fly in high elliptical orbits, which can see the main spacecraft, which weighs about 3 tons, while it's orbiting on the far side of the moon. And they take a signal from the Earth and relay it through a coherent transponder on the Relay satellite to the main, and then back to the Relay satellite and back to the Earth. That's called four-way Doppler tracking. That's the fundamentally new thing about the Kaguya data. The Kaguya spacecraft is almost a small laboratory orbiting the moon. It has 3.5 kilowatts of power and could light up your house. It's got a suite of 13 or so instruments, each one of which is returning huge gobs of data, and it will take years to assimilate these. Another thing I should add is it has 2 high-def cameras, which are taking movies, which you can see on Japanese public television in almost real time.
Is that a science experiment?
Yeah, that's not a science experiment, but it's an outreach that we wish we had.
So, Erwan, with all of this instrumentation and the previous missions and all the data that we've got collected, is the moon still changing today, other than just by, say, being struck by asteroids, dust, and warmed and cooled by the sun?
I guess for the most part, the moon is not really changing today. Most of what happened in history was much more significant in terms of magnitude. At the beginning, the orbit changed, the temperature was dramatically changed from, you know, very hot in early with the magma ocean to very cold today. There was basin formation. And today is more about micro bombardment of small meteorites that create the regolith on which the Apollo astronauts had to walk on. And also, we saw with the Apollo geophysical experiment that there are still moonquakes, deep, sometimes deep inside the moon and sometimes more shallow in the crust. So the moon is still like living. It's not completely dead, but I don't think that we can say that there are large-scale processes that are taking place today.
What's behind the moonquakes? Do we understand what's causing those?
Actually, no, we don't fully understand the moonquakes, but I'm not a specialist on this. The deep moonquakes, it could be the core mantle boundary, the interface between the mantle and the potential liquid core. This could be creating some kind of repetitive and rather periodic, as we observe, events, but there is no definite scientific explanation on those.
In addition to what Erwan said, I'd like to say a couple more things about how the moon's changing today. Since it has no atmosphere, meteorite impacts are continually bombarding the moon with tiny impact craters that are still large enough to be seen by high-resolution cameras. And these can be compared with images from the Apollo missions and other missions. This gives us an idea of what the present-day cratering flux is on the moon. We've seen several new craters formed in the last few years on Mars, for example. So this is how we calibrate the time scale of surfaces on planets in the inner solar system.
Well, Greg Newman and Erwan Masaryko, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Greg Newman and Erwan Masaryko write about the latest results from the Kaguya-Selene mission to the moon. Read their perspective, as well as the 4 papers with analysis of the mission's data, in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So we're here in Chicago, and I know you'll have lots of stories to talk about in the next few days on the Science Podcast, but what are some of the stories that you've been covering for Science Now from this past week?
Well, it's good to be here with you at the AAAS meeting, Rob, and as always, I've got 3 Science Now stories for you before we start getting into the meeting podcast. And the stories we're going to be talking about today are how to keep robots from getting stuck in the sand, how ants talk, and finally, how colors influence our concentration and our creativity.
Great. Well, let's start with how to keep robots from getting stuck in the sand. I suppose this would be pretty important for, say, the Mars rover.
Exactly. And even for people who drive over sand regularly, if you're driving over very loose sand, even vehicles that are built for this kind of thing can sometimes get stuck. And the problem is that as vehicles come in contact with the sand, if they move their wheels or whatever other appendages they might have too quickly, they essentially dig themselves a hole and they can get stuck in the sand. And they can prevent this from happening by moving very slowly over the sand, which prevents them from digging a hole, but they also take forever to get to where they want to go. So researchers thinking about future planetary rovers and just about how we can improve locomotion on sand here on Earth looked at desert creatures. They looked at lizards and cockroaches specifically, and they said, how do these guys keep from getting stuck in the sand?
What's the key? How do cockroaches and lizards do it?
Well, it turns out they use a combination of fast and slow motion. When their feet are in contact with the sand, they move relatively slowly to keep from digging themselves into a hole. But when their feet aren't in contact with the sand, in other words, when they're going through that motion of having lifted up from the sand and are about to touch the sand again, that's a very rapid motion. So they're returning back to the sand as quickly as possible. But while they're in the sand or while their feet are in the sand, they're moving very slowly.
So this is an insight for new robots that don't use wheels.
Right. And in fact, based on these observations of these desert creatures, the researchers designed a robot called Sandbot, which doesn't have wheels. As you said, it has these sort of elfin-like feet, you know, with a long foot and almost kind of curved up a little bit at the end. And what this robot does is, much like the cockroaches and lizards, when its feet are in contact with the sand, they move very slowly. But as they rotate around this wheel-like axis to reach their next point of contact in the sand, they go very quickly. And you can actually see a very cool video of this on the site. And what the researchers were able to accomplish after a year of tweaking this robot was they were able to get it to move about 15 times faster over loose sand than the Mars rovers currently do.
Is that going to be useful to NASA and planetary explorers?
Well, the team hopes it's going to be useful for any future explorers that are going to need to traverse sandy terrain and then are especially going to need to traverse it very quickly. But one expert points out that the current Mars rovers actually don't need to move very fast. They're looking at parts of the surface and they're going over these parts in very close detail. And so they don't want to go over these parts too fast. So this technology wouldn't be terribly useful for today's Mars rovers, but potentially for future Mars rovers or even for rovers that go to the moon or other places.
Well, from how a new robot walks to new discoveries about how ants talk. What kind of sounds are they making?
Well, Rob, researchers have known for a long time that ants make these chirping-like noises. And here's what a queen ant sounds like.
How do they make that sound?
Well, they make the sound by scraping a tiny guitar pick-like appendage on their abdomen against grooved ridges on their posterior. So think a wooden spoon scraping against a washboard. But researchers have always thought that these sounds are not really for communication. They're not really the ants talking so much as they probably just serve as an alarm call or something like that. And that's because researchers thought that most ant communication occurred via molecules that the ants emit. And it's sort of like they smell each other's molecules. And this helps them determine, say, whether the queen needs food or whether they need to go to the surface and protect the colony. So researchers didn't think ants had much use for sound communication. But that all changed with this study. A team of researchers looked at a species of ant called Myrmica schenkii, and they used these tiny little recording devices to get up close to the ants and record their sounds. And what they found was that the queen ants make different sounds than the worker ants. And that made sense because the grooves on the queen ants are actually wider spaced than those on the worker ants. And the fact that these different castes of ants are making different type sounds indicates that this audio communication is more complicated than researchers had been giving the ants credit for. And in fact, when they played back some of the queen's sounds to the worker ants, and they played back these sounds on these tiny little speakers, the workers crowded around the speakers, protecting them, as if they thought that the speakers were actually the queen and the queen was in danger. So this was further evidence that these sounds have specific meanings.
So they use both sound and these chemicals to help distinguish the different castes of ants?
Exactly. And what was also really cool, what the researchers found, was that caterpillars have learned to mimic these scents and sounds to gain access and privileges in the ant colony. Now, the researchers already knew that caterpillars could mimic the ant scent, but now they found out that the caterpillar also mimics the sound. They again use these recording devices, and they found that once inside the colony, the caterpillar makes a noise very similar to that made by the queen ant. And this gets the ants to start giving the caterpillar food and basically just giving the caterpillar the royal treatment. And so the cool thing about this story is not only finding out that ants talk and that this communication is a lot more complicated than we thought, but they've also found that there's creatures out there that have learned to mimic these noises to get what they want from the ant colony.
A parasitic relationship, then.
Exactly. And it's really cool because this is the first time this type of mimicry has ever been seen.
Well, from how caterpillars can influence ants by mimicking their sounds and smells, to how colors can influence us and our concentration and creativity, What's an example here?
Well, Rob, say, for instance, you're in a room and all the walls have been painted red. Researchers have shown in some studies in the past that that color red will help you concentrate better. So if, say, you're an accountant and you're working in a red room, maybe your calculations will be more accurate than, say, if you were working in a white room or a blue room. But these studies haven't been very clear-cut in the past. Some studies have suggested that red helps concentration and cognition, while other studies have even suggested that red hurts cognition. So a team of researchers suspected maybe these studies are testing different types of cognition, and maybe red helps some types of cognition but hurts other types of cognition. So let's try to be as specific as we can in this study. And what they did was they gathered a group of volunteers and they had them stare at computer screens. And sometimes the screen had a red background and sometimes it had a blue background. And the reason they chose blue is because there had also been some studies suggesting that blue might enhance creativity. So they wanted to test both cognition and creativity. And they asked the volunteers to do a variety of tasks while they looked at these different color screens. And in the concentration task, or the cognition task, the color of the screen could be red or white or even blue. And the volunteers were asked to proofread a list of addresses. So in other words, a task that would require a lot of concentration. And they found that when the screens were red, the volunteers did better on the task than when the screen was blue or white. So this was evidence that red does enhance this type of cognition, especially this type of sort of concentration cognition. And in another task, they looked at the color blue. And the researchers asked in this study the volunteers to come up with as many uses for a brick as possible. And they varied the color of the screen from blue to other colors. And some of the more creative responses were, well, you could use a brick as a scratching post for animals. And the researchers found that the more creative responses tended to come when the screen was blue than it was when the screen was other colors. So this was evidence that blue is linked to creativity.
Do researchers have any idea why red is more associated with concentration and blue more associated with creative tasks?
Well, they suspect it has to do with the connotations of these colors. Red, for example, is associated with stop signs, with red ink, and even with blood. So the color red might subliminally make us sort of stop and sort of think about something more or approach something more cautiously, which would lend itself to greater concentration.
Especially blood.
But blue, people tend to associate with more tranquil things like the sea or the sky. And so if you're seeing blue, maybe your mind is sort of in a more relaxed state where you're thinking more creatively.
I suppose we'll start seeing a whole new line of advertising based on this kind of result.
Well, that's an interesting point. And actually, in the study, the researchers also showed the volunteers camera ads. And in one ad, there was a picture of a camera, and along with the picture, all of the different features and the accessories that the camera had, and that was all in a red background. And the volunteers tended to respond better to that ad when it was on a red background. And the researchers suspect, but maybe that's because there's so much going on in that picture and so much sort of technology going on in that picture that the volunteers processed it better when it had this red background that was sort of activating maybe the cognitive or the concentration parts of their brain. And when they did a camera ad on a blue background, and this time the ad had more sort of a creative feel to it. It was sort of the types of pictures you could take and the landscape pictures and, you know, the portrait pictures and things like that. The volunteers had a better response to that when it was on a blue background than if it was on a different color background. So the idea is that advertisers could also learn a lot from a study like this because they might be able to target their ads better if they use different types of colors.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what can we look forward to seeing online on the Science Now site and the Science Policy Blog site during the AAAS meeting?
Well, Rob, during the meeting, we're going to be covering the meeting with our findings blog, and you can find a link to this on the Science Now main page. And every day, we're going to be posting a few entries about various sessions at the meeting, what new science is coming out of the meetings. We're going to be talking to some of the personalities that are there and just overall presenting readers with a lot of fun facts and fun anecdotes from the meeting, just to give people who aren't at the meeting a nice flavor for what's going on. And we'll be posting links to all the podcasts that you're going to be doing from the meeting, Rob.
We will.
Of course.
Great. Thanks.
and we'll also be running the science policy blog, Science Insider, during the meeting. And the blog is continuing to follow a lot of important developments, such as this big economic stimulus package that's happening in the United States, which science agencies are going to be getting what, and also looking at some of the ethical issues in science. Will President Obama be reversing former President Bush's order that limited the number of stem cell lines that researchers in the United States could use? So be sure to check out the Science Now site for a findings blog, and also remember to check out the policy blog.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus frequent blog updates on the AAAS annual meeting in Chicago, Illinois, at sciencenow.sciencemag.com. www.scienceonline.org. And that wraps up the February 13th, 2009 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. And please fill out our short anonymous online survey at www.sciencemag.org/multimedia. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.